famously sneered, 47% of us are really kind of in trouble, and we're getting used to it. But that's the point of billionaire rule. Get used to that. Get used to less. It isn't enough to hoard great wealth and to game the system to ensure that billionaires get more billions. The game isn't satisfying to the players until a groveling peasant class is created. The conditions of feudalism, with a glittering royal dynasty in charge of insignificant masses, as seen on TV. That's the real goal. The robber barons are back, and they want to be robber dukes and robber kings and robber queens. So, shall we oppose them? Or do you accept the new, revised, more dismal fate that's been decreed on high for you and your offspring from now on? Would you march to demand jobs at fair wages? Shall it be 15-50 or fight, or shall it be hail to our beloved masters? I can see plenty of the latter polluting the public discourse already, as with the television series lionizing the Shark Tank investor class. Have you seen that? Or the you're fired glorification of the egomaniac Donald Trump. The bootlickers are out there. But will they be opposed? Will we fight back? So I'm asking you directly. This is a call-in talk radio on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I'm asking you to call me and tell me what you think about the economic situation. I want to know what's going on with you. Are you currently in gainful employment? Are you doing okay? Do you know people who are couch surfing because they can't get jobs? Have you lost a job recently? Do you know someone who's been foreclosed? Someone who's in danger of foreclosure? Someone who's in bankruptcy? I'm in bankruptcy. I want to know about it. So call this number, 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. This situation, this denial of jobs with living wages, is making people depressed. Did you know we're having a suicide epidemic? It's generating a great deal of rage, but the rage is professionally redirected towards ourselves via the politics of resentment, via the Jim Crow drug war, and now possibly via new wars. A little concerned about that as well. I think there is only one appropriate target for class war rage, and that is against the dynamic that allows the instigators and directors of the one-sided class war to win. It's not even really against the billionaires. That's not really my problem there. It ain't just the billionaires. It's the system that we allow to be in place to allow billionaires to exist. I mean, how in the world can you have an egalitarian society where some people make thousands of times as much? They don't make it. They accumulate thousands of times as much as other people are allowed to accumulate. I want to know which side you're on. Do you plan to claw your way to the top of the servant class? Or would you prefer to fight for a society that distributes wealth and power on a more equal basis? Call in right now, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Let me tell you how bad things are getting. This is from WSWS.org, which is one of these socialist organizations, and they report, they have a couple of articles, they report in Detroit right now, where people can't get jobs. Because of the collapse of 08, because of GM's decision that they'd rather invest in Toyota than equitably distribute the wealth to the workers who created the wealth, they are the emergency manager there, which is what they have instead of a mayor, is planning to allow the shutoff of water services to 170,000 people. They're going to go forward with shutting off water to 170,000 households. And, here's a letter. As chairman of the workers' inquiry into the bankruptcy of Detroit, I condemn the decision by Detroit officials to begin the shutoff of water service to 170,000 households, which are more than 2 months later on their water bills. If this brutal and inhuman measure is carried out, tens of thousands of men, women, and children will be deprived of the most elemental necessity of life. In a city that sits astride one of the largest concentrations of pure water on the planet, up to 3,000 households a week will lose water for drinking, cooking, cleaning, disposing of sewage. This will inevitably lead to tragedies and death. Like everything else under capitalism, the corporate and financial lords who rule society see water as a commodity to be bought and sold for profit. Emergency manager Kevin Orr wants to squeeze every penny that he can out of Detroit City residents in order to make the water and sewage department more attractive to private investors. Hey, does that sound familiar? Like to know what you think. And Bob is on the air. Number to call 503-231-8187. And can you hear me, Bob?
Yes, I can.
What you got to say?
Well, I used to work for the TriMet Lift, and I was fired during the whole union battle that we had. And I really just, I'm upset at the fact that taxpayer dollars are going to private corporations when TriMet really should have just made the lift its own service, just like the long buses.
It would save money, and it's been proven time and again that privatization costs the taxpayers more. And everything, you know, from sort of service that you were involved in to roads, no matter what it is, you can always spend more money by giving it away to private investors. But somehow they've managed to control the media to the point and the public mind to the point that they can still get away with claiming that it's going to be more efficient. I remember that Portland School District number one, you know that I'm a bus driver, or maybe you don't. Maybe don't, but I am. And I used to drive for Portland School District number one, and they got privatized. And guess what happened to the amount of money going in and the amount of services coming out? Just the typical.
It's amazing. And they specifically, at least First Transit, targets the most vulnerable populations to cut service to. Because if you have, if it takes X number of tax dollars to perform a service the right way, but a company comes in and says, I can do it cheaper, that you know that they're cutting something. There's no way that they could cut some, that they couldn't just, you know, make more money, keep a lot of it for themselves, and provide better service. It doesn't work that way. It can't work that way.
No, because it puts a middleman in the flow, and the middleman's idea and intention is to drain money out of the system.
Absolutely. It's, but, yeah, now I'm working for minimum wage for a company which also It performs the same service, also contracts through TriMet to take a lot of the very same passengers that I used to take before, but I'm making minimum wage with no health benefits and in vehicles that are TriMet wouldn't use.
And that means that your life is getting steadily worse and worse, and you're trying to find ways to catch up with the bills, which cannot be paid with minimum wage.
They can't. I'm very fortunate for my current living situation, but if I had to pay regular rent, I couldn't do it.
You know, I think a lot of people would like to be able to pay regular rent, whether they are currently doing it or not, which reminds me, it's 32 days till May Day, 32 days till International Workers' Day. What do you think? Are you likely to hit the streets this year?
What are the chances that I'm going to get beaten by cops? I'm still going to do it.
Well, I've managed to keep from getting beaten by cops in demonstrations, I should add, for these many years. So it is possible to do it. But, you know, it's funny you should mention that because that's the whole idea, isn't it? Is to have the terror out there to keep you from expressing your First Amendment supposedly guaranteed rights.
Well, I'm not afraid. In fact, I'm so supportive. I know there are going to be people out there in Guy Fawkes masks. I'm just going to paint my face as Guy Fawkes.
Oh, excellent.
I'll be there. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and Theodore is on the air.
Hey, I just thought I'd tell you that I was mistaken. When I called up the screener, she said, your name is Teresa and you're a girl. And I'm sorry, I was mistaken about it. I thought you were a guy.
Surprise, I'm transgender.
Oh, are you? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I won't go there anymore, but anyway. Okay, so anyway, the one thing that you probably already know about, do you know about the U6 unemployment figures versus U3?
They're different. They're calculated differently.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the U6 are more legitimate, and they're about twice as much. But if you go to a website that's run by an award-winning economist, he runs a private website, and he does consulting, he says if you, in fact, calculate it like it was done in the 60s and 70s, and the 50s, then you've got even higher than what they're publishing in the U6.
Yeah, the statistics for the Bureau of Labor, the BLS statistics, have been cooked since the Reagan administration. Reagan was the first one that came up with the idea of adding in the Army to create a false employment level. And there have been various other tricks as well. And you do have a little bit of, backtracking on the hedging with the various indexes, but there isn't an index officially that counts all of the people who've given up work.
Yeah. And I probably won't be out there for May Day. What I'm doing is I'm helping a guy file a $50 million federal lawsuit in the Ninth Circuit somewhere against a government.
Well, that sounds like work.
That sounds like some fun stuff.
All right,
I enjoy it. So.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Never trust the bastards because they all lie.
Well, thank you for your call. The number to call, 503-231-8187, and I'll go to the next caller. I dropped the name. Sorry about that. Hello there. Thomas. Whoops, Thomas is not on that line. We'll try again.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me, Teresa?
Yes.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Yeah, I like the way you began the program talking about, are you a serf? Do you want to be a serf? And I would submit that effectively, very much a majority of people in our society are serfs. You know, it's interesting to note that if you go back to the Gilded Age, or the first Gilded Age in American history, so-called back at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, when you know you had the likes of John D. Rockefeller and the big oil trusts and Carnegie and the steel and all of these huge monopolizations of economic power and the attendant complete corruption of the judicial process and the representative government by these entities. And of course, this is all well documented. You know, there was lots of discussion about wages and indeed going back to the just immediate post Civil War era and even back to the revolutionary times. A lot of the thoughts of the founding fathers that the idea that that having to work for wages and hours is very much akin, of being either directly a form of penury and servitude, or just a hair's breadth away from it. And, you know, as far as, you know, why people accept this, I think that you have to look at the dominant economic model that's promulgated by contemporary U.S. Society, you know, and really embraced by both political parties, is essentially, it's not really a science. It's more of a religion because there's
That's a really good way of phrasing it, I think.
Right, because it's
a dogma.
It's not really meant to be questioned outside the box. It's not meant to be analyzed outside the bounds of itself. It's meant to be believed. And, you know, and one of the things that betrays this is the language around it. You know, the whole idea of saving, the virtue of saving money versus the evil of spending it. You know, and you combine this economic model that is no better than religion. And look at economists in society. If you graduate with a degree in economics, where are you going to be employed? Oh, sure, maybe you might be another academic teacher, you know, teaching in the university. But who else employs economists? You either end up being essentially a functionary and a servant of the status quo, or you end up what you might call as a priest economist, where you basically advocate and promulgate the mythology. And, you know, the United States, it's really interesting to look at what's happened, how the frog has been boiled, you might say, with the standard of living. You know, you look at the amount of the GDP of the United States, in other words, the per capita GDP, the amount of so-called money generated in the economy divided into how many citizens. And if you look at the United States, you know, there are many other countries in the world that have far lower amount of money in the economy generated per person than the United States, that have a much higher standard of living. And ironically, you can even go to the belly of the beast itself. You can go to the CIA.gov. You can go to what's called the World Factbook.
And their stats will show that. Yeah. Well, that's true. Well, that's partly, or mostly, I would say that's because in a lot of countries besides the United States, certain commons are recognized. Healthcare is a commons. That's something
right.
to be shared. That's socialized, you know, like roads. We have socialized roads. No one ever calls them that, but that's what we do. We have socialized fire departments. You know, they're red. Oh my God, Look at that. But we won't socialize our basic needs. And not even water, as I was saying, in Detroit, they're going to cut off 170,000 people. That is the most draconian thing I've heard of in a while, yeah. But I can't say that I'm surprised. I mean, that was the whole idea of putting that emergency manager, or should I say navigator, in charge in Detroit.
Well, right. And see, what is this? This is the textbook definition of fascism. I mean, what is it? Benito Mussolini's quote is saying that essentially the alliance of state of corporate power and state power is fascism. I mean, whose interest is it that all those people's water would be shut off? Is it the interest of the common good? Is it to help people meet their basic needs? Who is this serving? You know, you're talking about economic model that serves an absolute minority.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. Cui bono, you have to ask that. Who does it serve? I mean, for example, here in Portland, we have a proposal coming up on the ballot that is supported in part by Wacker Siltronics. And if you want to know how Wacker Siltronics feels about usage of common water resources, well, just go down to their plant on the river and look at that reddish sludge coming out and ask yourself whether you think you might like to have a drink of that.
Absolutely, absolutely, because there's no incentive. When incentive becomes profit, and profit alone, anything you can do to cut costs is a desirable goal. And anything you can do to destroy regulation so that you can cut costs is a desirable goal. And that takes up my final point is that, you know, on all these discussions about, well, can we afford to do this? Can we afford to have health care? Can we afford to have clean water? Can we afford to protect the environment? Can we afford alternative energy? You know, all of these... And the attendant attack on public housing programs, the attack on publicly owned infrastructure of all types, be it transportation, be it energy, be it water, you know, this fits in with the ideological myth and the folk religion itself, because the important thing, it's not just making the profit off of these individual services, there's an ideological goal, and the ideological goal is very clear, and that is you cannot have an example. You know, the people who are the plutocrats that are making the money, the big money in our society, who are effectively in the control seat, do not want the power of a good example.
Oh, that's very true.
And
you've made some really great points there. I do have some people waiting to get on the horn, so I'm going to go to them. And thanks very much for that call.
Okay. Thank you.
Number call 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Everyone, well, I don't know if everyone, but a lot of people have heard of the Koch brothers. But have you heard about their political front group, Americans for Prosperity? They've aired more than 17,000 broadcast TV commercials in the 2014 election cycle already. That's according to Robert Reich, writing in Alternet. He says that's compared to only 2,100 aired even by Republican Party groups. Americans for Prosperity has been outspending top Democratic super PACs in nearly all of the Senate races Republicans are targeting this year. In 7 of the 9 races, the difference in total spending is at least 2-1, and Democratic super PACs have had virtually no air presence in 5 of the 9 states. Now, that's not saying that I support the Democrats' way of... their way of supporting billionaires is somewhat more subtle. But that tells you what billionaires can do. But the number to call, 503-231-8187. And Francis is on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I thought last week we were living in heaven in Portland, Oregon. The gifts that we were given with that beautiful sunshine, and I've never lived here during spring. I was actually holding my breath wondering when it's terrible when we can't, we're so used to being abused. Something good happens, we hold our breath to see what else, when the bad stuff, that's really sick. This country, I think you're on the right track, man. But the prices will fix the inflation. And the price that we have to pay for stuff. In 1970, I bought a really nice Camaro for $3,000. Today, I think it's worth probably $50,000.
Well, and funny thing, but you could buy those cars for, about a fifth of your annual income on average.
And we had the gold standard. I had a really nice two-bedroom house with a full basement. I didn't have a garage.
And it didn't take up your whole paycheck.
It was $13,000 when we bought it. At these inflated prices. Greenspan, he was on Charlie Rhodes one time, and he said when this started crashing, that they'd have to fix the prices. But what the banks have done is they've sucked up all those things on foreclosure. They're holding them in their portfolios to maintain the prices. There's never been a price freeze in this country. And that if we freeze the prices and not work, the poor people will win, and I'm calling it out.
You know, actually, there was a price freeze. It was 1973 under Nixon.
Yeah. I know everybody hates him, but he did some damn good things.
Funny thing, he was the last president to expand the welfare state.
Well, there is no such thing as a welfare state. If we're kind to one another, we don't need a welfare state. If we can go, the economy, there's nothing backing up this money. There's a girl on YouTube that's 12 years old, and she told the Canadian government in about an eight-minute speech how corrupt and dysfunctional the monetary system is in the whole world.
And it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? We think we're happy. We think we're in heaven. We're in hell. And we're going to go biblical here for a minute. I don't like to do this.
Let's get biblical here.
Yeah, let's get biblical. It says in one part of the Bible that Babylon was the whore of the world. Well, this country, this government is the whore of the world. And there's nothing that says, well, we know what happened to Babylon.
Well, it's certainly available for the billionaires. For example, the billionaire Ameritrade founder Joe Ricketts and his son, co-owner of the Chicago Cubs, Todd Ricketts, have their own $25 million political operation called Ending Spending. Guess who they want to end spending for? Not for subsidizing
their
operations.
The poor people.
Yes, the group is now investing heavily in TV ads.
I just moved here for Oregon in May. And they said, I'm poor, I like it. I like it a whole lot better than when I had money. Honestly, it's a very interesting state of being when you can wake up. Freedom from want is nirvana.
Well, now you want and need heat. You need water for a certain. I'll bet that the water is on at your place.
Right, right.
And that's what the billionaires want to cut us down to.
But I'm living in a low-income complex that the man owns. Seven other complexes, two of them that I know of, will accept the HUD Section 8 and the Oregon Health Oregon Low Income Plan. But he owns seven other complexes, and this complex plays Gestapo games. They've already done it to me. I don't like to be pushed around, and I don't get mad very often. I asked the people that run it. I said, I like to talk to that boy. Now they're saying they can't. Nobody can move in or use the hot tub because they don't have any more keys.
Well, May 1st is coming up. How do you feel about hitting? I would like to see ongoing and escalating protest.
We need a whole day of this. That's why people are so sick. They're in fear.
Thank you very much for your call. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Yeah, the billionaires are spending up this election, as you might expect, since we lost the right to free speech to the right for billionaires to flood the airwaves. The group that I was talking about, Ending Spending, from the billionaires, the Ricketts, are a funny name for billionaires, are investing in TV ads against Republican Representative Walter Jones in a North Carolina primary. They blame him for too often voting with Obama. They have an ad attacking a Democratic New Hampshire Senator Jeanne Shaheen for supporting Obama's health care law. And it's become a template for similar ads funded by the Koch brothers. When billionaires supplant political parties, candidates are beholden directly to the billionaires. And if and when those candidates win the election, those billionaires will be completely in charge. At this very moment, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, remember him, $37.9 billion, is busy interviewing potential Republican candidates. Yeah, he's interviewing the candidates who he might fund in what's being called the Sheldon primary. A quote from Ari Fleischer, former White House press secretary under Bush, says, "Certainly the Sheldon primary is an important primary for any Republican running for president." So that's what it's come to. We allowed Citizens United to come through. We allowed the Supreme Court to pick George W. Bush back in 2000. Do people remember that? That we lost our capacity to elect presidents in 2000, and that the Supreme Court picked a president. And since then, if you want to be president, you go directly to the billionaire and see if you can lick his boots better than somebody else. Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Now, if you're wondering what the end result is supposed to be in the United States under billionaire rule, you could, for example, turn to Ukraine. Professor Mitchell Chusadovsky writes in Global Research, in the days following the Ukraine coup of February 23rd, leading to the ousting of a duly elected president, Wall Street and the IMF, in liaison with U.S. Treasury and European Commission in Brussels, had already set the stage for the outright takeover of Ukraine's monetary system. The Euromaidan protests leading up to regime change and formation of an interim government were followed by purges within key ministries and government bodies. The government of the National Bank of Ukraine was fired on February 25th and replaced by a new governor, a member of the Stephen Kubiv, a member of the Parliament of the Rightist Fatherland faction in the Rada, that's the parliament, led by the acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who's also he's a Nazi. He previously headed Credbank, a Ukrainian financial institution largely owned by EU capital with some 130 branches throughout the Ukraine. He's no ordinary bank executive. He's one of the first field commandants of the Euromaidan riots, along Andriy Parbi, co-founder of the neo-Nazi Social National Party of Ukraine, which has been renamed Svoboda. And Kubiv was in the Maidan Square addressing protesters on February 18th, at the very moment when armed right sector thugs under the helm of Dmitry Yarosh were raiding the parliament building. And the latest news on that comes from Reuters. This came in this morning. The International Monetary Fund and Ukraine are discussing disbursement of $3 billion in the first tranche. That's what billionaires like to say for any bunch of thing. Have a nice tranche of potatoes. You want a tranche of gravy with that? The first tranche of a $14 to $18 billion bailout package, Ukraine's finance minister said on Friday. The deal announced on Thursday, which will also unlock further credits to a total of $27 billion, is intended to help the, get this, heavily indebted ex-Soviet republic stabilize its economy after months of political turmoil. Now, that's the way the corporate news talks about Ukraine. It's funny that they've become an ex-Soviet republic all these years after 1990. It seems like I think there's been some years between 1990 and now, and I think that they were a capitalist economy. Gee, that's hard to say for some reason. And I would bet that 24 years of capitalist economy has had some effect on them, so that one would not normally call them a heavily indebted ex-Soviet republic. One would call them a heavily indebted ex-capitalist republic, if one were to be straightforward about it. But that's Reuters for you. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Where I was going with that is that there's more in today's news, actually, I'd like to tell you about. The Kiev government, they say, has taken a step towards the IMF by announcing it will raise gas prices for domestic users by more than 50% from May 1st. Now, it's kind of cold in Kiev, and you need your heat. And there were already complaints in the U.S. press that the Russians were likely to raise the price of gas. Well, guess what? The Kiev post-Maidan government has already announced a 50% hike. And that's, you know, given how cold it is in the spring right now in Kiev, that's approximately as cruel as cutting off 170,000 people of their water in Detroit. And frankly, it's the same bunch of people. It's banksters. But anyway, Tom's on the air. Number call, 503-231-8187. Whoops, Tom's not on the air. Tom couldn't wait all that time. Sorry about that, Tom. So we'll go to the next caller. And I'll just check with the engineer and see if that next caller's coming up here. Looks like that caller's coming around the bend. You can kind of feel the electricity. Ah, hi there.
I'm coming.
Okay.
Hey, your points are right. It's the same people that are cutting off the heat, that are cutting off the water. It's the cold hearts. It's people who like to do cold things. It's people who can never have enough because they're dead. We have the zombies amongst us, and they're wearing suits, or sometimes they're dressed up in Birkenstocks.
They're really kind of sad people. I mean, if you look into their lives, they were raised by nannies. They don't know their own mamas, hardly. And they're cold. Billionaires tend to be very cold, distant people, and they can't get enough because they're trying to satisfy human needs with economic conquest.
There's a soul vacuum. There's a soul vacuum, but you know what? Unfortunately, it goes all the way down. There's a real prolific problem amongst the ruling classes, but certainly you can find it amongst every rank of people. And there are the cold hearts versus the living, breathing hearts. And I think we've got to help Detroit, because Detroit, what was it a while back, what caught my attention 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, they were having their streetlights turned off. So imagine coming home to a black, dark neighborhood with, you know, increasing concern about crime, understandably, which is, of course, the correlate of economic distress. But anyway, so no streetlights, roving packs of dogs because there's no animal control and people have had to abandon their pets or whatever and move away, and then now no water. I think we've got to help Detroit, and I'm not joking.
Well, I think you're right, and one of the first ways we can help them is let people know that this incredibly draconian thing is going down, and simply tell the emergency manager of Detroit, this is not acceptable. We will not cut off water to our fellow Americans. You're not allowed.
Yes, yes. And you know what? Not just email. We've got to find their city address, and we've got to flood it with regular letters, hundreds of thousands of letters coming in, and get a reporter over there saying, look, these are real letters. This is communication. Don't turn off that water. But we have to do more than that, because they're going to turn off their water because they're going to make an example out of Detroit. And I don't think it's just a coincidence that Detroit is still largely a African-American population city, because we just can't hit the minority people in this country enough, the Indians or the blacks or the poor white trash. We just can't hit them enough because they're inferior. They're not good enough. And I believe that they are. I believe they're plenty good. I think they're beautiful. But we've got to figure out a way to help Detroit. And I want to try and make sure that those people's water stays on, and I'm going to come into KABU and I'm going to try to put something together throughout the community to help those people. I hate the thought of them not being able to have water.
That's kind of the point I'm trying to make on the show, is it's time to take action. It's time to consider a direct action. I would like to see on May 1st a reemergence of something like Occupy, but obviously taking a hint from revolutionary movements, we have to be more active, and we have to just keep, the great thing about Occupy is it kept things in the headlines day after day after day. That was the whole point of being out there. And it may be that tactic needs to be repeated, but in some way, I would say that things need to escalate until we actually get results, because as long as protests can be isolated, can be reduced to one day or 2 days or something like that, then they can be ignored. But if we absolutely won't stop and won't shut up, then we can get results. Hey, thanks very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and I believe I heard that Rachel is next. Hi. Hello? Rachel, can you hear me?
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about what you were talking about earlier on, just the working world, because I'm currently a full-time student, and I had I became a medical assistant, to make a little extra money while going through school. Come to find out, the university I attend, though, only has morning classes that's offered. You know, so I had to quit that job, and I was unemployed for 4 months, and now I work a minimum wage job, because it's almost impossible to find a job in that field like that.
And what's more grinding than a minimum wage job?
And I'm sorry?
What's more grinding than a minimum wage job, going to work and knowing that no matter how well you do the job, you're not going to get enough to cover your bills?
Exactly. And this job, the job that is really, in my opinion, shouldn't pay. I work in a community protection program, and our job is to monitor sex offenders and other, criminals that are considered mentally incapable of being in jail or held somewhere else.
For minimum wage, you do this?
For minimum wage, yes. And my job in particular, I work the graveyard shift, and one of our responsibilities is, at the house I currently work at, is some of these people are flight risks. They just take off randomly. And, you know, I'm a young kid, you know, if someone takes off in the middle of the night, 3 a.m. in a bad neighborhood where the house is, for minimum wage, I'm not really, you know, it's not really encouraging to me to want to go chasing after them at
just
that time of
hop
night.
Hop on your bicycle and go after them, huh?
Yeah. but also I wanted to say, I feel, you know, in some ways that that poverty, going deeper into that is almost encouraged by the schools themselves. I mean, for the school I attend right now, the tuition yearly is $16,000 a year, but I don't have any children. I'm not married. So I only get an allowance of $8,000 a year. So if I want to go full time, my parents have to take out a loan in their name, or I just have to scrounge up the other $8,000 and pay out of pocket to attend school full time. And when I called the financial aid office, it's absurd to me. They literally told me, they're like, well, you're not married. You don't have any kids. Have you thought about that? It was just outrageous to me. I just couldn't believe that, they were like offering that as an option.
You hear the most ridiculous things. I'm reminded of Walmart saying to its employees this past holiday season that perhaps they could sell something in order to give Christmas presents this year, since they're working at close to minimum wage.
That they could sell something?
Yeah, that was a suggestion from the CEO, trying to help out the employees. They're not going to raise their wage any, but maybe you could eBay something and give Christmas presents that way.
You know, take more time.
There you go, guys. See, I'm on your side.
Yeah, well, I wanted to call and make a comment. I feel like, which way you turn left and right, I'm noticing the farther I go into my schooling, the harder it is just to even go, just to even attend. I'm hitting roadblocks left and right just to try and continue going, and I haven't even reached my bachelor's yet. I'm working on that right now.
That's excellent that you called in and shared your experience, and I'm sure that your experience is shared by a great many. Number call 503-231-8187 at 9 on One Land Many Voices on KBOO. Host Zaya Hassan and Ned Rush, I probably just mispronounced those names, interview Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb about justice and peace, and film actor producer Waleed Zewaiter about his participation in the film Omar at 10 o'clock. Air Cascadia is off today, so we'll go straight to Flashpoints, featuring an extended interview with writer, actor, and director Diego Luna about his new film Cesar Chavez, a biopic on the legendary founder of the United Farm Workers. And at 11, we'll hear part 2 of a program from the Pacifica Archives, highlighting an historic conversation between two radical and influential women from the feminist era of the 1970s, artist Judy Chicago and writer Anais Nin. KBOO Portland, you're listening to Positively Revolting. I'm Teresa Mitchell, in for Lynn Mullick and Ani Haynes. And the number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And go to the next caller. The engineer, Kristen, has dutifully told me who this person's name is, but it just went in one ear and fell out the other. So I'll just go to, Shelley is the next caller, I believe. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Teresa. I just want to make a couple comments. One is, you were asking how folks were doing, and my husband and I are both still employed. We work in union jobs, and we have benefits, and we're really happy with what the union has provided for us. So I just want to give a shout out to unions and hope that we can get more action.
Hell yeah. I think that people need to stop putting down unions and just grab some courage and form a union. And if you're wondering how to do it, well, use a search engine, how to form a union, and you'll find some very interesting and helpful hints. And it's not impossible.
Right. And also just a lot of good comments on the show, but you mentioned something about action, and you mentioned May Day, but I think Occupy is planning something for April 4th to kick off Occupy 2.0 or whatever, so they're trying to get actions going. I'm not sure what's going on in Portland, but and then leading up to May Day and going through to July and just getting more people out on the streets and mobilized. So.
All right, well then I will just use my electronic device and see if I can find the Occupy page. Here we are, occupy.com. and see what they have to say about that. Thank you very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I'm pulling up Occupy.com. And let's see what they've got to say about the latest. I don't see it right in front there, but April 4th was what I heard. So maybe one of you can look that up as the program's on and to give me some more details. April 4th, is it? Occupy Action. Glad to hear that. And so I'll go to the next caller. Joel.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, Joel.
Hey. Hey there. First off, I want to say, Teresa, your shows are always the most pertinent, and they're excellent. It's always upon what's pressing. I like that about it.
Thank you.
To the core. I just had two comments that, for one, I'll say a kind of preface of saying I think we need a revolution. I mean, as you're saying, you know, this is almost not the question anymore. And then there's something that people admire, Noam Chomsky and Richard Wolff, an economist, think as far as a prag, you know, it's a pragmatic way of moving forward, and it's not very exciting. But you know, there's like tens of millions of people who need work, and there's tons of infrastructure work to be done. I mean, this could be you know, and we saw it after the first crash of 29, and I just think, I mean, you know, unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, but you know, these things have to have, revolution. You know, the day after the revolution, we rise up is a very interesting question. It's talked about a lot, but I think that you know, just to alleviate a lot of suffering, to create jobs and to rebuild our, you know, you could do mass transit, you could do, you know, green energy, you could do just general infrastructure.
Well, and taking direct action with your fellow citizens is a great way to alleviate depression. I don't know when I ever saw people so fired up as when Occupy really got rolling in this town, and so many thousands of people hit the streets, and wow, the smiles and the body language and the vibe was just tremendous.
Absolutely. I would say the last thing I'd say is Occupy, you know, didn't have demands, and it's talked about a lot as well, is pros and cons. There are, I think, both to it. I've fallen into the belief, though, that to make a demand can, I would just pose it might up the pressure, and I just think incremental, revolution is necessary, yes, but the day after the revolution, the only thing opposing is what do you make as policy? And I'll just let you guys talk about that.
I think that's a good point. We need to have some direct utopian thought. It's like, what do we want? You know, and certainly for a start, I would say that we can demand jobs at fair wages. I've been saying $15.50 or fight, and the usual complaint against that would be, oh, with what money? But that's a ridiculous question, because if the U.S. government can come up with the Federal Reserve and the Treasury can come up with more than $20 trillion with a T to give away to the same banksters who crashed the economy, then hell yes, they've got enough money to employ us all at advantageous wages if it should come to that. And so I don't take the usual demurral seriously. Thank you very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I've been asking, what is your economic condition? Have you faced foreclosure? Do you currently have a job? Do you know someone who's couch surfing because they can't get a job? Do you know someone who graduated from school and still can't get a job? I'd like to hear about it, and I'd also like to know what you plan to do about it, and is May 1st in your mind at this time? Number call, 503-231-8187, and I'll go to the next caller. Sylvia. Hello, Sylvia. You're listening to KBOO Portland, taking calls at 503-231-8187, and we'll try it again. Hello, Sylvia.
Oh, okay. Try again.
Hi,
All
Sylvia.
Right. Thank you for being on the air. There's something about you when you're on the radio. There's something, there's a courage there that I don't find anywhere else. It's really remarkable.
KBOO's great for that.
Well, I'm speaking about you specifically right now.
Ah, thanks.
So, and it's not necessarily what you say, it's just something that gets transmitted. Anyway, okay, let's see. I'm just on a little bit of Social Security. That's all I got, and I don't own anything. I don't have anything. I don't have anything electronic because I'm allergic to it, and I wouldn't want it anyway because all it does is destroy the planet. But I have a question on these these totally insane people that are, I mean, Mother Earth is for sale. We already know that, right? They're going to grab everything and anything. And they're talking about economy this and economy that. And frankly, to me, the word economy by now is a four-letter word. but the thing is, the basic premise is, if you haven't got an Earth, you haven't got an economy. So what is their plan after they have completely mutilated, tortured, poisoned, excavated, et cetera, just to get another dollar? What are they going to do after that?
Well, I think that's a great point, and it's another reason that we do need to have a revolution so that we can introduce democracy to the United States, because I think that if you poll the greatest number of people honestly, and if they answer on an informed basis, they would not agree to destroying the climate and the land and the air and the water of the planet. They would take some other course. Certainly, it would be like a complete reversal of what we're doing right now.
Absolutely. There needs to be a total reversal. The life, the kind of lifestyle that most of the world is in, it doesn't work. And besides that, we don't need it. What's all this material stuff? It doesn't feed your soul, you know? Okay.
Excellent point. Thank you, Sylvia. The number to call, 503-231-8187, and I believe Dion is next. Hi, Dion.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, is this Teresa?
Yes.
Hi. Are we on the air?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Thanks. First of all, I think your show is great, always, and I have just a couple of suggestions and questions. First is, May 1st is very important, of course, and I see it more as a kickoff point rather than what we did for that year, you know?
Yes, and, yes, I quite agree. Yeah. And that's the way I'd like to present it.
Yes, and the thing is, Occupy did, as you rightly point out, really raise everyone's spirits and everyone's confidence and belief in the power that we all have when we all act. And one of the things that I'm hoping is that, in addition to bringing our awareness to all of the really countless terrible things that are being done in this country right now, that we can also find a way and time to talk about what is being done about them by the people. This gives really a lot of encouragement to everyone. For example, I'm sure that they're not taking it lying down in Detroit. And the caller who said, we must help, I agree with that, and we need to have a means to do that, a way. If there were a way, I know that there's an ongoing organ, shall we say, called Yes Magazine, which is the only magazine I subscribe to because I need this positive input every month about people who are organizing and doing great things. And there are many of us, but there need to be many more.
That's a great point.
And I think if people, I mean, the feeling of helplessness that comes when you deeply understand the depth of the problem is enough to make a lot of people just go, well, there's nothing we can do. It's not true. There is something we can do, and we have to do it, because if we don't, I think we're going to die feeling we let our democracy fail, because you're right. The terrible people are the terrible people, and they are in power, and we are complicit if we don't stand up against it. We have to do this. And so if it's Occupy or whatever it is that we get involved with, we need to be involved. If it's the Wobblies, if it's the Union, if it's some way your neighborhood association, but bringing up these points that we all need to be talking about. The first one is, what do we want? Because you can't just fight against what you don't want.
That's a good point. Gets back to that point about utopian thinking.
What is our vision?
Let's do it. That really gets me to thinking. I often look at science fiction, for example. Science fiction has an effect on the popular consciousness. And what we've seen in science fiction, the trend in science fiction over the last couple of decades and more, has been dystopian writing, which is fine. You can write great dystopian novels, and that's where you're at. You know, more power to you. But yeah. I remember that in the 60s and early 70s, there were utopian science novels, and I quite enjoyed them. They were utopian. I still have a paperback. Actually, I think it belongs to my partner, come think of it, but still have a paperback of utopian feminist sci-fi writing, and that was great. But that was the reason I bring it up, is that is thinking about what we want the world to look like in the future, what direction we want to go. And we have to do that first. We
Absolutely.
Have to decide what we want.
Just a quick note on that, Teresa. There is a group, the Community Rights Organization. There is a group ongoing, I believe, in Portland, and a group in Washington and Spokane, who has actually gotten together, drafted a community rights, a list of community rights, and have fought to put it on a ballot, and that includes having local control over the water, the air, the earth, and everything related to the needs that we as human beings all share.
The commons, which we should respect instead of allowing the billionaires to despoliate.
Yeah. And so
I think I have enough.
Anyway, I let you go because I want everyone else to get a chance to talk. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for your call. Great points. And I think I have time for one more call, so let's do that. And I think that would be David. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to say that I really enjoyed your show and what your callers had to say. But I think that, you know, lately I've been on a little binge. I saw a Chris Hedges video on YouTube, and I since watched every Chris Hedges video I can.
That sounds like a great thing to do, watching Chris Hedges videos.
Well, he nails it down, and he has been through revolutionary situations, and he realizes it happens. And what we really have to do is just to convince, we are the 99.9%. After all, you just need to convince everybody else that that's the case. And then
we are the 99.9%.
Yeah, we are. And I think that once everybody realizes that where we are, I think that this supposed power that we give to maniacs is just going to fall apart, because it's all by our own consent. And when we all say no...
Yeah, let's withdraw our consent for the despoliation of the planet and the impoverishment of the masses. And when I say masses, I mean
everything.
Me and you.
Exactly. Your last caller said, you know, they're doing the reverse of what they need to do. So it's very easy. I mean, there's a million great ideas out there and a million places we need to go and things we need to do. But...
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have just run out of time, so I want to say
Thank
you very much for calling in. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 o'clock on KBOO, One Land, Many Voices, hosts Zaha Hassan and Ned Rush interview Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb about justice and peace in the film. Coming up, Omar is the name of the film. So stay tuned to your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland, and all the ships at sea.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, One Land, Many Voices, after this.
By being alive, you change the world. Change the world by being alive. By being alive, you change the world. You are the world.
You're already qualified to help us change the world. Join us at our next volunteer orientation on Monday, April 7th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, here at your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO's winter membership drive is right around the corner, starting on February 6th. And we need your help in raising $94,000. Can you show leadership by offering a matching gift of $500 or more? These generous matches have proven to be very successful in helping KBOO raise money. If you are interested, please call KBOO at 503-231-8032 extension 207 or email us at membership@kboo.org. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Good morning. My name is Zaha Hassan.
And I'm Ned Roche, and you're listening to One Land, Many Voices on non-commercial, listener-supported radio, KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
For the first half hour today, we'll be joined by Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, co-founder of Shomer Network for Jewish Nonviolence and a longtime activist in support of Palestinian human rights and justice. Rabbi Gottlieb will be speaking about her support and work for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to compel Israel to uphold Palestinian human rights.
In the second half hour, we'll be joined by Waleed Zawaiter, Palestinian-American actor whose latest work is playing an Israeli agent in the Academy Award-nominated film Omar. But first, Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, welcome to One Land, Many Voices.
Shalom, marhaba, how are you?
We're fine. So Lynn's speaking with us from Berkeley. Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, your resume includes performance and visual art, community organizing, peace educator. You're on the advisory board and rabbinical council for Jewish Voice for Peace and a Freeman Fellow at the Fellowship of Reconciliation. You've engaged in Palestinian-Israeli conflict transformation since 1966, co-founded Interfaith Peace Builders, and you've led many FOR delegations to Iran and to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. You've also been one of the first women to become a rabbi. This year, you co-founded Open Tent Shul of the Arts in Berkeley and co-organized Facing Urban Shield Action Network with Nora Corey to resist Urban Shield and the militarization of police. That's an amazing background and resume, and we would just ask you to share with us, if you would, a little bit about your journey specifically into the Palestine-Israeli conflict.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here this morning and thrilled to be sharing time with the amazing film Omar, which was maybe the best film I've ever seen. It was incredible. My journey started young because I happened to be born at a time in 1949 and grew up at a time when I was the first generation born after the Holocaust. So the stories that I was hearing around me very much concerned what had happened to the Jewish people in Europe and their genocide, and the message I received was one could not be a bystander. At the same time, the rabbis of my youth in the Reform Jewish movement were very active in the Southern freedom struggle in the South, and especially Rabbi Michael Robinson, who remained active in the struggle for human rights throughout his life, Alav Shalom. He and a group of his colleagues came back from jail, I believe in Birmingham, and spoke to us about the need to never be silent and to be public when you see injustice. And so those two narratives merged in my mind. And then I had the opportunity to study in Israel as part of an exchange program, which I did. I first lived in Upper Nazareth and then in Haifa. Almost immediately, literally the first night I was there, I was being driven up a hill to Jerusalem with other young people who were part of this program, and a very famous, perhaps the father of Israeli tourism, Zev Vilnai, was our guide, and he began to tell us about what he called Arab villages, and I remember then being somewhat shocked. I didn't realize that history. And being a very curious girl and having grown up in a theatrical family where my mother was a puppeteer and a storyteller and her friends, I approached my confusion by seeking out, I guess today we would call it an informant, you know. Then it was, I really wanted to meet someone from the Arab-Israeli community. And I met Atala Mansour and about 50 other members of the Palestinian community in 1966, and began to ask questions about what it was like to live in Israel. And from those questions, I received a history a story that I was neither prepared for or well understood, but it began my long journey to try to work on conflict transformation and bring justice to a very unjust situation.
What you've talked about is your coming into this issue from a place of the Zionist story that most of us grew up with, if we were Jewish, and then confronting something that is just so vastly different from what we were raised on. And for many of us, you know, who come from the Jewish community, which is on most issues fairly progressive, fairly liberal, then to confront this one, it can be an earth-shattering experience. And I'd love you to just chat a little bit about how that went down for you.
I was so young, I guess you could say. I was 17 and perhaps more flexible in my thinking. I'm sixth generation American Jewish and as well, so my connection is really to the United States and in terms of growing up and the Jewish culture that I grew up in and so forth. So in a way I was lucky to go and see in 1966 before perhaps things have a hard, things have definitely hardened so much since that time. And because of the liberal atmosphere of the rabbis also in Israel, Rabbi Samuels, who at the Leo Beck High School where I was studying, he in fact made it possible for me to meet his Palestinian colleagues at the Rotary Club and religious events. So I actually had a kind of normative experience, I guess. I mean, obviously it wasn't very normative, but I thought it was that this is just kind of a natural thing that you go, you talk to people, you meet people, you find out what's happening with them. And that was in a context of having discerned already then what racism is. So I recognized it. I could see it. And it was always very clear to me that where I should stand. And it was shocking to realize as I grew older that not everyone stands there.
You know, Rabbi Gottlieb, when you were there at the age of 17, was it 1966?
Yes.
So that was, there was still military rule going on for the Palestinian citizens of Israel. Did you note that? Was that evident to you?
No. It was not evident to me. I was not able to distinguish between the vast presence